right. My name is Angus Henderson, and today is July 17th, 2019. I'm talking to Sally Hsu, who runs the Visual Resource Center at the Oklahoma State University Art Department. This interview is a part of the OSU Diverse Sexuality and Gender Oral History Project, specifically focused on the LGBT history of OSU. So we usually start at the beginning, which is where and when were you born?
Buffalo, New York, 1959.
Buffalo! I thought you were from further south than that for some reason.
A lot of time spent with family on Manhattan and Long Island.
Oh, did you grow up there in Buffalo?
Till I was 11.
First of all, what did your parents do?
My dad was a chemical engineer. My mom is a teacher. Home economics.
Oh. Since it's just audio, we don't get to see that hilarious face you made.
She's a horrible cook.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, boy. So you were there until you were 11?
Yeah.
Then where did you go?
Chicago suburbs.
Oh, what moved you there?
My father's job.
Where did he work?
He was working at some chemical engineer firm.
Oh.
The 60s and 70s. I mean, I had nothing to do with my father's job. He didn't talk about it. It wasn't, you know, part of the conversation. So.
Oh, okay.
So I don't know.
Do you have siblings?
I do. I am the oldest of three. I have a sister who is 18 months younger than I am, so a year and a half younger, and a brother who's 5 years younger.
We're both eldest children. No wonder we get along. Okay. Well, I wanted to ask about Buffalo, but since you were so young when you left, how about we talk about Chicago? Mm-hmm. Was it kind of a culture shock for you?
No, it's one suburban development to another. They were pretty homogenous. So I was going to interject. You were asking about, you made the comment about being the oldest. And I think in the context of this interview, there were a lot of ways my being queer, I abdicated the eldest role, in that my sister was dating, my sister was, you know, like all of the social firsts, the curfews, the, you know, pushing against my parents in that way, my sister took care of.
Oh.
Well, I didn't date. I didn't go, you know, I did not do all of those things in junior high or high school. I had no interest, right? I didn't have any interest in boys. I didn't have any interest in... So my sister's role became the one that... She's the one that got in trouble. She's the one that argued for curfew times. I spent junior high and high school babysitting.
Oh, not babysitting your younger siblings.
No.
Babysitting other neighborhood kids.
Children, yes.
That's usually who you babysit. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. Was that like something your mom suggested or something that you wanted to do? Or babysitting?
It was the only way to make money.
Oh.
What else was I going to do? I don't know. I mean, girls didn't mow lawns. I was in the suburbs. I mean, that's what you did. Although, I gotta say, I mean, I started in sixth grade in terms of making money. I started doing a like summer child care thing where the neighborhood kids got dropped off at my house for like 2 hours and we did games and stuff, which I can't imagine in hindsight how amazing that would have been for a mom to have 2 hours of time to bring their kids over. And so, yeah, so I always, that was something I always did.
It makes sense.
Yeah, I got my first bicycle that way.
Oh.
50 cents an hour, $100 Schwinn. That took a while.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Could you actually bike to places from the suburbs, or was it?
Well, you bike to friends' houses, or you bike to a park, or you bike to, I don't know, the swimming pool.
Your standard suburban stuff.
Exactly. So.
I was going to ask what you spent your money on, but it sounds like you saved up for a cool Schwinn.
Yeah.
What was high school like for you?
In what way?
Did you have a lot of friends? Did you bike to school? Were you involved in extracurricular activities?
I was social. I got along with everybody. I think I... So... I have mild cerebral palsy, and the it's another category of otherness, and I think the gift of that was that I had a very mature and developed sense of empathy. So in terms of friendships, I often was friends with some of the kids that got bullied and were ostracized for whatever reason. If I was to go through a list, I would say one girl, it was class situation. She was extremely poor. Another was a girl in that I became friends with in fourth or fifth grade who was very heavy. But the other sort of cross, I was never in any particular group, you know, like high school gets divided into the cool kids and the stoners, and that there was a lot of how I operated in otherness, right? So I didn't engage in being labeled a particular way, and that gave me some fluidity and some flexibility with the kids that I was friends with. That said, I had deep friendships with just a few people. So not really any different, not less or more than like my sister or brother or anybody else around me, but
that's cool. This was the 70s, huh? I guess there was a stoner group.
Isn't there always?
I guess so. I wasn't there. I don't know.
No, I mean, today in high school, aren't there the...
Oh, there totally are.
Yeah. I mean, it's... you know, the kids that get in trouble, the kids that come to school high, that... You know, that's how they deal. You've got divisions with the kids in AP, right? So I was always in the smart, you know, in those AP classes.
That seems cool.
I think a lot of I spent a huge amount of time reading, constantly reading. I was just a geek in that way.
I don't blame you. It sounds like a good alternative to, I guess, becoming a stoner.
Going to 7-Eleven, I don't know. didn't have a lot of appeal to me.
Yeah, it doesn't seem great. Like, you clearly knew you were not interested in boys. Were you interested in anybody else?
I had a very intense, non-sexual relationship with a girl through most of junior high and high school. It was fairly... exclusive is kind of a weird word, but neither of us were dating. She was straight, but that continued into my mid-20s. And at that point, we were, seeing other people, but we were pretty inseparable. And there's, stacks of letter correspondence and...
That's really sweet.
Before we jump all the way through high school, I remember you told me about this once that I think you were about 11 when you became a vegetarian.
Yeah. You want me to tell that story?
I would love that story.
So it was the summer and we were at my grandparents' summer home, which is in Long Island, where we spent the summer. And it was one of those, you got three TV stations or you got one TV station because you were out in the middle of nowhere. And NBC had something called a white paper, which was an hour long sort of news focused on one story. So Rachel Carson's Silent Spring and DDT and, how that was affecting. I remember that one. This one was, why can't I think of the woman's name? The author for Diet for a Small Planet, which was looking at how much it cost financially and in terms of resources to support animal protein versus non-animal proteins. And that there, in the 70s, there was also a lot of conversation about the population explosion. So the sustainability of the planet and the number of people that were living here, blah, blah, blah. And so Diet for a Small Planet was about eating non-animal protein as a way of, decreasing your carbon footprint, but the food analogy to that. And I was 11, going into sixth grade, and I was really excited that I could personally make a difference in the world. Like, this felt like a doable mission. And so I announced to my mom that I wanted to be a vegetarian. She at the time, I think, was getting teaching certification to go back to, so she was in school, get teaching certification to go back into the workforce as a teacher, and taking behavior modification classes. The reason I think this is because very uncharacteristically, she said, "Sure, you can be a vegetarian." And I was very excited. I was like, "What do I have to do?" She said, "Well, to get enough protein, you need to eat, like, let's 6 eggs for dinner." Of course, as an adult, the idea of 6 eggs makes me want to throw up. But I was 11 and could eat anything. I made a giant omelet and I was very proud of myself and I ate it, no problem. And I was like, okay, Mom, what's next? And I viscerally remember the doorway she was standing in and she was beet red and she just yelled at me again, very uncharacteristic of my mother, and said, you will not be a vegetarian as long as you're living in my house. So I sort of worked on that issue again when I was in high school. And by the time I was a senior, I wasn't eating meat. I think it's this, I mean, besides the fact you're setting up Mom to cook special food, you know, like it was all she could do to put food on the table for five, like, right, having to deal with some child that's, you know, making different choices was just too much for her. But I also think it had to do with that equation of food and love.
Oh.
And that there was some way I was, you know, rejecting her. So that's where I think it came from.
Oh, but you're still a vegetarian. You still feel strongly about this.
I eat fish. Once I moved to the West Coast and was in Seattle, I ate fish.
That didn't happen for a hot second after high school, though, did it?
No, that was after I graduated as an undergrad. So I was, how old are you? 20? 19, 20.
Okay. Well, let's back up a couple of years, though. Because, like, you graduated high school, and then what did you do?
I went to college.
Well, you never know.
I know, but that's what I did.
Where? What made you choose your college?
I was given no choices. I did do a little, you know, visiting college campuses. My mother seemed to have, I had no autonomy. My mother had no imagination, and we were going to like home economics kinds of programs, which I had no interest in. I wanted to be an artist. I was told, basically I applied to the state schools and went to the University of Illinois Champaign. I went into interior design as a freshman, because I knew that all of my survey classes, all of my freshman classes, were exactly the same requirements as what I needed to get into the sculpture program. So as a senior, as a sophomore, I declared my major and my parents pulled out their financial support.
Oh my God, what did you do?
The student loans.
They just yanked all of it because you switched your major?
Because I switched my major to art.
Oh, you clearly felt strongly about it though.
It's what I wanted to do.
I can tell. How did you like it once you got into like sculpture courses and art courses?
People talk about, like, I graduated from a high school of more, my graduating class was more than 1,000. And people talked about the state schools, University of Illinois at that point was a very, it was a large university. Like OSU, it was in a rural part of the state. It was not an urban community. But going into the, I think any program you go into, you have a cohort that makes the experience much smaller, right? You in the sculpture program, there were 15 students of the same class. I mean, it was a larger, but like there were 15 sophomores that started together and went through for the next 3 years. I had a very, there was a very tight group of women in the program. It was the late '70s. It was an extremely sexist experience. I would say it still is. I would say that that environment still is.
Oh. So you spent 3 years with these 15 people?
Well,
and smaller...
pretty much four.
Oh.
Because I was taking the same, right? I was taking drawing one and art history in, you know, it's just, so it was the same group of people for the 4 years.
I would imagine that group of women would stick together in an environment like that.
Yeah.
You were all friends, it sounds like, or were you just kind of comrades?
It depended. I mean, you know, the other thing that was happening when I was there is I started a nonprofit women's run art gallery. So I started is a little overstatement. I started it with a group of other people. Some of them were University of Illinois students, undergrads and grads. Some of them were part of the community college, and some of them were sort of other artists in the area that were involved. There was I'm trying to think of the percentage of lesbian to straight women. It seemed half and half, but sort of the radical feminist separatist stuff was all happening. So some of it was pretty strident, and the more radical with a small r were the lesbian women in the group. So
that seems to be how it usually is.
Yeah. So I mean, this was a time of people going off and protesting nuclear sites and creating women encampments and protests in that way, women land communities. So that was the context, the '70s.
Did you get involved with that?
Oh, no. I mean, I had friends that were, but it was a little too. It was a little too. It was like organized religion. It was like being in a sorority. It was just a little too structured in terms of having a defined label.
Mm.
Right.
Plus, it sounds like you were busy with this art gallery.
Well, as much as I was busy with school. I mean, that didn't have anything to do with not being involved with the other women's communities or feminist projects that were around.
Oh, what else did you get involved in?
What do you mean?
With these feminist projects and all the...
Well, what I'm saying is I didn't particularly. I mean, I was friends with people that were, but I wasn't interested in that kind of group.
Radical sorority.
Maybe you could say that. But just that identification with the group. Mm-hmm. So, and I was busy. I was going to school. I was working. You know, there's only, there's only so much you can do.
There's only so many hours in a day.
Exactly.
Where did you work?
The university library in the rare book room.
Oh, that must have been cool. Yeah.
Library geek.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that follows.
Read a bunch. I mean, I worked in libraries from sort of junior high on. Instead of going to gym classes again because of the CP, I had time where I worked in the, you know, I was in the library shelving books. Here I am in the Visual Resource Center with my little books and magazines as well as all the technology that's in here. So you kind of don't get away with it. You know, you're like, what are you doing when you're in sixth grade? You may be doing this the rest of your life.
So. Well, it doesn't sound like a bad spot.
Yeah.
But with this kind of half lesbian and half not lesbian cohort, at least so far as the women goes, had you had lesbian friends before?
Before college?
Yeah.
Possibly, but nobody was out mm-hmm. in high school. You know, there wasn't, for me, there wasn't a label. There wasn't a, oh, I'm not interested in boys. That means I'm something else. I mean, I'm trying to think of when, I heard the word. I mean, even like a gay man, like when did I hear that referred to? I don't know. I mean, maybe as we talk, it'll come up and I'll be like, oh, right. I think our bodies ourselves was one of the ways that I sort of navigated sex and, you know, the fact that I was female. There was a lot of dissociation from my body, both because I didn't connect with the straight model and because of my disability. So there was a lot of, I lived in my head. I was sort of, I mean, it's an extreme thing, but the sort of like I was not, it had a kind of monastic, intellectual, like I was of the world of the mind, not the world of the body, so that there was this real schism and I didn't have to deal with navigating things that seemed really complicated. And to be in your late teens and early 20s and not have a lot of sexual experience means that, and not a lot of role models means that, you know, there's a little, even more awkwardness because you're older, right? You're not experimenting at 14. I mean, I suppose there are lesbians in the 70s that were experimenting in 13 and 14, but that wasn't me. And I think that some of the disability otherness was in the way of that, right? I'm not a sexual being because I have this body that works differently. Mm-hmm. No. And I know that this is audio and transcript, but I mean, my CP involvement, my neurological involvement is extremely minimal. I'm ambulatory. As a kid, I, you know, rode my bike and went swimming, and my mom had us doing a lot of physical activity, specifically, I think, because she was told by the doctors that that's what I was supposed to be doing. So ice skating and swimming and whatnot.
That's so fun. Or, I mean, did you like it?
To some extent. I mean, I was, of course, more comfortable in things that were not competitive because I was horrible at it, right? I mean, I didn't walk like other people, which meant, you know, I couldn't run and I couldn't, you know, like soccer, really? No. Right?
Did she try to put you in soccer?
Oh, God, yeah.
Oh, no.
Yeah, so.
Yeah, you've never seemed very competitive to me. I can't imagine trying to put you on a soccer team.
Well, any kind of sport was not that interesting.
But you saved up and got your bike.
I don't think of a bike as... Bike was transportation. Bike was independence. Bike was not sports.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you still don't drive a car, do you?
I physically can't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So bike is definitely independence.
Well, I can't bike anymore either.
Oh, dang. Plus, you live way out there. It'd be hard to bike around. Let's get back to college.
Yeah, sure.
What was the kind of the academic part of the sculpture department like? You told me it was sexist. Was it all male professors or?
Oh, yeah.
Did you get a good education out of it at least?
No. I got a very good academic education. I had a minor in art history. I took a lot of literature classes. I was always very weak in math, and I'm not sure if some of that was buying into a sort of stereotype about girls not being good at math. So any aptitude that I had in science, I didn't pursue after high school. So all of my academics were in the humanities. And I got a very solid academic background. I think the sculpture program, one of the ways I dealt with it was sort of the same way I dealt with a lot of other things, where the things I was being challenged by, I just decided weren't important and I wasn't interested in. So this male machismo, representational bronze. Oh my God, the conversations about the permanence and non-permanence of art was extremely boring to me and ridiculous. So there was a lot of what I would refer to as femtech, not welding, but sewing, or not welding, but constructing in some other way, like just going around the type of skills that were male defined. Now, that said, not all of the women in the department worked that way. You know, some of them were, you need to tell me what this is, you need to show me how to do this, I'm just entitled to this as You are. I did not have that level of maturity. And looking back at it, what I needed to understand was they had the technical information, and just because I wasn't interested in their aesthetics, representational bronze portrait heads that, you know, of Mayor Daly, for God's sake, I didn't, in hindsight, that's very clear that that's what I needed to do, was to separate out the technical from the aesthetic. And I just rejected it all. I rejected their aesthetic. I rejected my ability. That said, there wasn't a lot of outreach by the grown-ups to make sure that I graduated with the technical skills.
It sure doesn't sound like it.
No, not at all.
So what did you go toward rather than the representational bronze Mayor Daly heads? What were you doing instead?
What was I doing instead? What was I like? I mean, it's hard for me to think about the artists that... So I can go back. I grew up in Buffalo. The Albright Knox Art Gallery was there. The Albright Knox Art Gallery was a small gallery, but again, in hindsight, looking at what was in the collection, they must have been, whoever was in charge of acquisitions was purchasing purchasing stuff right out of New York Studios. So I have a very visceral, I mean, somebody in the library is going to go, well, I know who all these people are. But Lucas Samaras' mirrored room was in the center. There was Marisol's baby doll, a Kenneth Noland painting, Andy Warhol's Brillo boxes. There were some, why can't I think of his first name? Bell, very minimalist metal and glass pieces. So when I came into college and you were taking those survey classes that started at the, you know, cave paintings to, I don't know where it got cut off in the 16 weeks. But I was so blown away that all of these art students were starting from this point that art was representational, that art was the Renaissance, that art was, that that's what you aspired to make something look like what you were seeing. That never occurred to me to be a goal. I had no interest in representational work. So to me, walking into and getting introduced as a kid to those, you know, giant sculptures of, well, they seemed giant to me, the Marisol's baby doll and the General, which is a large horse with, you know, a crank under its tail that played, I don't know, the French national anthem or something. And what I remember is George Washington dressed as like Napoleon. I mean, I can't remember all, but the point was, it was like a playground. It was totally accessible to me. It was something I could engage with both as a observer and as a participant. And my mom took us to all sorts of museums. We went to all kinds of performances and readings, and this was part of my education. Now, much to her horror, you weren't supposed to aspire to be an artist. You were just supposed to be a patron. And she completely bought into this idea that the artist was a genius. The artist was not a normal human being. Of course, an artist would never be your own child. And just like the parents today in the art department, they just fear for the kid's ability to support themselves. So anyway, we are not talking about queer stuff, but
that's okay.
Okay.
It's not your whole life.
No, it's not. But I think it informs it. I think that embracing the sense of otherness and not fitting in all kinds of aspects of what was expected gave me a lot of again, I don't care, you know? I don't care that I'm not dating. I don't care that you think I shouldn't be an artist. I don't care. You know, there was just a lot of, this is who I, it gave me a lot of power to step outside of that kind of conformity. And that was terrifying for my parents because, of course, they grew up in the, well, they didn't grow up, but they were coming of age in the 50s, right? Where it was all about conformity. That was the goal, is to be similar.
That makes sense. I see why you were so disappointed by the art department, the faculty.
I mean, the disappointment's also in hindsight, like comparing my experience then to my other experiences going back to school as a printmaker, seeing the art department at OSU and the kind of rigor and the expectations for the students here, their experience seems much more successful.
Okay. Yeah. So it sounds like you did make it through that first program, at least.
Well, I've been a working artist my whole life, so yeah,
Well, good.
Yeah.
And you were still helping to run this gallery of women artists, right?
Yeah.
Did you continue to do that after graduation?
No, because I left Champaign. I didn't stay after college. I moved to Seattle the second I could. But I continued to seek out and be actively involved in other arts organizations. So I was involved with a group called Seattle Print Arts. It still exists. At the time, it had about 300 members. I was on the board for 2 or 3 years, and then I was president of the organization. We organized exchanges with China, how I was over in China. We hosted Chinese artists that came over here. I created an art space. I had the opportunity to have a 2,000 square foot studio for a fairly low rent. In fact, yeah. So I created part of it as a working artist space called a project space. And my idea and how it was executed was that the artist came in to work in the space for a month, and the culmination of that was an exhibition in the space. So it was sort of not quite a pop-up space, but an alternative space. And my again, my focus on it was this idea of, for lack of a better way of explaining it, sort of pulling the curtain back and demystifying the artistic process. So the artists were allowed to create events where people came to see the work in progress. The website certainly documented it that way. I'm trying to think about what's on the site. So a community engagement in the arts was always there. You can't make work in isolation. You just can't. You really need to create a community, and the community exists, is sort of handed to you when you're in school, and that's where, you know, attrition kicks in, is when you get out of school. If you don't have that environment, there isn't a way to sustain. You know, who's going to be in their studio for 4 hours after work or 8 hours on the weekend if they don't have accountability, if they don't have support? So back to kind of the diversity, queer context of that, I was always more engaged in an art community than the queer community. And my access to the queer community was sort of a subset. So, you know, the queer artists that I worked with, but not separate involvement in like a queer organization.
Well, there are lots of us in the arts. It seems like a pretty good way to get to know us all.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of even how, what organizations were, if I had any awareness of what organizations were out there to be involved with, and I can't. I just mean, it just wasn't on my radar. It wasn't my focus.
What took you to Seattle?
Mountains and ocean. I lived in the Midwest. I hated the Midwest. The Midwest is flat. The Midwest is ugly. My upbringing had me spending most of my time on the East Coast. Again, summers in Manhattan and Long Island. And that all seemed a little too intimidating when I got out of college. I did not have a strong sense of my ability to handle that. So Seattle seemed doable. It seemed manageable. It was in a place I was interested in being. It was significantly cheaper than San Francisco. I'd have to look up the date, but there was one point with the Boeing. So Seattle was a one town, you know, whatever they say, like a one company town, and that was Boeing.
Oh.
And when Boeing went through a crash and was laying off everybody, there was literally a billboard in Seattle that said, "Would the last person in Seattle please turn out the lights?" So I moved to Seattle in 1980. There was no functional downtown. You know, everything shut down at 5. You didn't go down there. There wasn't a shopping core. I mean, it was a very, very, very different place. I always thought it was really funny that people thought of it as a city, because it seemed to me to be just a very big town. You know, I mean, my experience was Chicago and New York, Boston and San Francisco. I mean, those were cities, and Seattle just wasn't. You could, you know, walk from end to end in an hour. Blah, blah, blah. What was I going to say about that? I mean, when I first got to Seattle, unemployment was 11% in the country. You know, it was, but I didn't have the kind of student debt that students have now. So unemployment is low. but are you making enough money to pay back your student debt? So there's just different challenges now than there was when I was in school. So I started working at the University of Illinois. I mean, the University of Washington, sorry.
Oh.
And I literally stayed in that position for 32 years. And the job evolved. I wasn't doing the same thing, but I was working in the same department. And I rented an apartment that I later purchased. So I think I rented for 2 years and then purchased it. I was the youngest person in the building to buy at the time. I'm now the oldest person that and have owned the property for the longest of anybody in the building. So all that is to say, I'm very rooted, a taproot. I put down roots and I keep them there.
I can tell.
Yeah.
What did you start doing for the university? What was your job?
I worked in audiovisual. I worked for the Child Development Center, which was incredibly ironic. So I was doing recordings of mother-child interactions, you know, scientific research on kids, the behavioral development, disability issues. And the irony there was my mother dragged my sister and I around to these stupid studies when we were kids, and I hated them. Well, you didn't have the, you know, consent. I didn't know what was going on. You know, I was sitting in a room with one-way mirrors and microphones and being recorded. By the time I was doing, I was on the other side of the glass running the cameras, kids had grown up with video tape. They knew, you know, what being on camera was. They saw a camera and they completely switched, right? That you switch on, you like smile and you engage, and you know, that wasn't the context I had. So it was very ironic that I was in that environment.
Oh.
Yes.
But so what department was that in? That wasn't the art department.
No, it was child development. So they rebranded it the Center on Human Development and Disability. So I was working with behavioral psychologists primarily.
Cool. And this is when you started working on your gallery space, or was that later?
No, that was a lot. I mean, we're talking 30 years, right? So
that's why I'm asking.
No. I mean, I worked there full time for maybe 10 years, 15 years, and then I blew out the discs in my back, so I had a bunch of herniated discs. I had to drop from the MFA program I was in, and I ended up just getting a post-bac in printmaking. And I dropped my workload at work to 3 days a week. Initially, the level of pain I was in, the amount of disability I was dealing with, I was working one day on, one day off. So I was working like a Monday, Wednesday, Friday kind of situation, because I couldn't do 2 days in a row. And then when I got better, I changed my schedule to 3 days a week. And so I was working 3 days a week at work and 4 days a week in my studio. So I had created this really supportive structure for my art practice. Right, I got insurance, I had vacation. I worked there long enough to have more vacation time than you could imagine. I mean, I had months and months and months of vacation accrued at one point. You work there 30 years. You get a lot of vacation accrued.
I would hope so.
Yeah. So, yeah.
That's so cool.
Yeah, it was a very, nice structure.
Like, I know only a little bit about your art practice now, and you're doing a lot of text, kind of using the laser cutter.
Yeah.
What were you doing then?
Text-based work, this idea of seeing the difference between reading and, now my little elevator speech about my work has completely gone out the window.
Oh.
Being able to identify something and read it, but have that reading obscured so that it becomes just a visual experience rather than a written experience. But I've always been, my work has always been focused on the written word. And sometimes I was combining that with visual, photography and writing. But it's also, I mean, that also comes out of artists in the 80s that were, Lorna Simpson and other people that were using text and image together. So text as image became something that evolved for me. And I went back and forth between combining them and separating them, and sometimes just doing things that were without text just to kind of prove I could. I did a lot of video because I had access in the same way. Now I have access to a laser cutter. It's how do I use that tool to make work?
That makes sense. Yeah. And you were doing your second degree there in printmaking, right? Was there a lot of printmaking involved in this practice at this point? Or was that sort of your springboard to do what you wanted?
What's your question?
How much printmaking did your practice entail while you were working in printmaking?
Exclusive. I mean, if I did a residency, I had access to a press. I made prints. If I, when I was in school, I had access to a press. I made prints. I mean, I was involved in Seattle Print Arts for, 10 years. So, but that said, a lot of my, because I didn't have access to a press continuously, I mean, there were places sort of like Prairie Arts where you could go rent time on a press, and I did that, but a lot of it just became works on paper, and both sculpture and printmaking inform my work in terms of how I work with my materials. Thinking of my work can, the way I can think about it can be very three-dimensional or assemble kind of thing. Anyway, yeah, whatever.
That's so cool. I'm getting to ask all the questions that I've kind of had floating around.
For me?
Yes.
Specifically? Oh, yeah.
But we're like getting into the early 90s here, aren't we?
In terms of my, so I got my degree in printmaking, and I think it was 90, yeah.
Had you heard about kind of the first burblings of the AIDS crisis happening in San Francisco, New York? Was that on your radar at all?
I would not have phrased the AIDS crisis as something that was burbling on my radar, Gus. The AIDS crisis was decimating the community before it had the word AIDS. And yes, I was very aware, and I was very aware of ACT UP and the political work that artists were doing. Just a quick aside, I was very surprised during the Reagan era, the around Contra, the war stuff, that there wasn't more political engagement, artistic, political, overtly political work out of that time period. There wasn't, but there was around the AIDS crisis. I think, you know, Reagan represented a very conservative sort of, you know, Thatcher and Reagan, and you had the punk movement, and you had this kind of class rebellion. I think the queer community was definitely you're talking urban poor, you're talking about people that are surviving on very little and really relying on community. So anyway, the AIDS crisis was, I was just very aware of it. I had friends or friends of friends that were dying. One of my friends lived in the apartment I had, and in my 20s, I think I was very close to Steve, so it was not just friends of friends, but it was some of the people in my direct circle were dying. And it's a very strange thing to have your peers, you know, people think of their grandparents as dying, you know, uncle so-and-so in their 70s or 80s or whatever, but you're talking about people in their 20s. And a horrible, you know, this is not something that took you down quickly. This is, you know, and there was so much stigma. Steve's family, you know, he died of cancer. He didn't die of AIDS. I'm trying to think of the year that was. I'd have to look it up. I can't remember. It was the 80s.
I never know when to start asking about AIDS because people have such different times of becoming aware of it. I kind of aim for the middle and like around 1990.
No, it was the 80s.
Oh.
When did Rock Hudson die?
That was like late 80s.
Yeah.
Yeah. So around then.
Yeah.
I've heard him come up before a couple of times.
Yeah.
Oof. I know Stonewall, you were a kid when Stonewall happened, but was that any kind of like...
No, I didn't have that. That was college, though, and I was aware of Stonewall.
Like, yeah. As you got to know more about the kind of LGBT community.
Yeah. Well, you know, when I was reading a lot of feminist queer theory kind of stuff, so, and it was, again, all, you know, Kate Millett. And...
Yeah. It's wild. But Seattle was in such a economic downturn, I suppose. But it's started to come back up, I would say, by now. But where was it in...
You mean by now being...
2019. Just a little bit.
You're... Understatement is in the extreme, my friend.
When did it start to turn back up?
I don't know. I mean, what the cultural shift that's happened was Amazon. But, you know, Microsoft and Amazon were there at the beginning. And so maybe Microsoft money in the... mid-80s. I mean, time frame seems very weird to me. It's really like how is this 2019? How is this like almost 2020? Like, I graduated from college 40 years ago. Like, how do you even say that sentence? So trying to put any of this, you're like asking me a question that requires a timeline. My timeline is totally fucked up. I mean, I can't, you know, it's just too skewed. It's just all blends together, like what happened first and what happened after that. It's hard for me to do that.
There's been a lot going on.
There's a lot going on, and some of it you're aware of, and some of it you're just very, you know, involved in your own chaos and angst-ridden, hormone-driven, you know, nonsense.
Oh, were you dating at this point?
I was dating in my 20s. But I didn't have a serious relationship until I was 29 or 30. And that lasted 5 years. And then I didn't date all that much. I tended to focus on my work. I tended to focus on my art. You know, it was all pre-internet dating. There was one lesbian bar in Seattle. There may have been two, but there was one that was close to my house. It's actually still there.
What's it called?
The Wild Rose.
The Wild Rose. What a great bar name.
So, because my community was more art than queer, it was more of an effort. And because I had so much practice, I don't know if that sentence makes sense, because so much of my coming of age was disengaging myself from my sexuality, from a kind of cultural community support thing, that was not hard for me to continue to do. I generally got involved with women who had to beat me over the head to get me to pay attention. So they were both obsessed and persistent. Otherwise, it just never occurred to me that somebody would be interested in me. Not even subtle cues. Like, everybody else was like, oh, come on, Sally. And I was just like completely oblivious. I wasn't trying to shut it out. I just had no context. I just didn't get it. And I just was so stupid that way. So really, somebody had to be not only incredibly overt, but persistent beyond what I think any human being should have to do to get somebody's attention. So, yeah.
Not to spoil the story, but I know your wife, and this explains everything.
Yeah, well, it kind of does. We met at an artist residency, which she loves this story, and I abhor it because artist residencies can be known as hookups, right? And and what stays at the artist residency, you know, so people were stepping out on their relationships, their marriages, their, you know, and there was a certain amount of that behavior. It's not consistent, but it is a stereotype, especially the residencies along the East Coast. So you had folks that were graduating that were getting their MFAs in those schools, and then they became like residency sluts. They would just go from one residency to another. So that's in an artist residency, they're generally paying for room and board. So it gives you a way to survive and have a studio. So you're pretty motivated to, you know, write those applications, and if you can string them along. But that also means, you know, you don't have a home, you don't have a pet, you don't have a, you know, you're able to, I don't know, put yourself stuff in storage or be living with someone that you just leave your stuff for months at a time. But generally artist residencies were 1 month, but you had to have a certain amount of flexibility. So go back to Liz and I. Liz and I met at an artist residency. She was in a relationship. I think she had been living with Margot for 5 years. She, you know, it was a 4-week residency. I think week two, she's like confessing her love, and I'm like, are you fucking kidding me? Like, it's 2 weeks. Like, what are you even talking about? Like, I just didn't want anything to do with it. Like, you're with somebody. Like, this is like not, this isn't okay. And so so to her phrase, we kept our pants on is how she phrases it. So it was, you know, there was a group of us, and relationships at residencies can be very intense. They're like summer camp, you know, you get these, you have these bonds, and some of them continue. I am certainly in touch with a few people, and that was 2003. So, you know, it was 16, 17 years ago. So to be still in touch with 3 or 4 of the folks that we spent our time with is kind of nice. So she broke up with Margot and called me and said, you know, can I come to Seattle? She was in Madison at the time. And I said, I'd think about it. And she lost her shit. She was like, are you kidding me? I did this the right way. I have broken up with my relationship and can I think about it? But I was really trying to navigate whether or not I thought I was okay with it being a fling. Because I could not, we were in two different places. I couldn't see it as a relationship, right? So am I okay with this being a fling? And I decided I would be. Because I also assumed that meant I was risking the friendship, right? You get involved romantically and it doesn't go well, then I don't know. The whole lesbian thing about being friends with their exes has never been like my experience or my interest. It's like, we're breaking up for a reason. And I really, no, I'm not going to try and navigate being your friend. And that was really contrary to sort of the expectation in the community, right? We're family, everybody's family. Liz had all of her exes at our wedding, right? Because she worked really hard. They were her family. And just because her relationship changed with that person didn't mean they were less family. So anyway, we got together. Liz was in Vermont. We were in Vermont at the residency in May. In August, she went to Japan for 3 months. And this was sort of before Skype, and we communicated via email. And I think we talked once on the phone. There were cell phones. I don't remember. But she's an amazing writer and an amazing storyteller, and that's when I fell in love. That was like, okay, I'm in. We're doing this thing. So.
Oh my god! But y'all didn't like move in together immediately because she was still there in Madison, wasn't she?
Yeah.
What happened next?
Long story short, we were in a long distance relationship for 10 years until I moved to Oklahoma.
Oh my god. Was she running residencies and for that most of that time?
No, she was at, well, some, but not predominantly. I mean, I'd have to look, but I mean, she was adjuncting like any other MFA, you know, and she was looking for a tenure track job, and she got one here. I'm trying to think of how long ago that was. She's on her second sabbatical, so 14 years ago. And I've been here 5.
Okay. So she came down and you were still up at Seattle?
I wasn't going to leave a 3-day-a-week job and 4 days in the studio and come to Oklahoma. It took my job ending. It took the dissolving of the department for me to leave. And I was applying for jobs in Seattle as well as in Oklahoma, mm-hmm. at that point. But the long distance was viable only because I was able to take three days off work, right? Take my 3 days and have 12 days down here. And I could do it a lot because I had a lot of time, vacation time. So the long distance relationship worked because Liz could live in Seattle for 4 months out of the year. She was an academic. She could be there 3 months in the summer and 1 month over Christmas. And I could be down here every 5 weeks, every 6 weeks for, you know, 2 weekends in a week. So for 12 days. Or whatever that ends up being. I mean, I could do a long week, 7, 8, 9, 10 days. Yeah. So it worked. It wasn't ideal. It wasn't ideal. I mean, we wanted to live together. I didn't want to live in Oklahoma. And Liz didn't want to live in Oklahoma. Mm-hmm. But, you know, tenured track teaching gigs are, in painting,
hard to come by, I'm sure.
Hard to come by. Well, medieval art historians or, you know, I mean, the academic job market is incredibly competitive and there are a lot of people out there with advanced degrees as, you know, master's and PhD folks running around.
When did you... The whole department dissolved that you were working at?
Yeah.
Oh.
Well, the AV, they restructured it, mm-hmm. I think. And they restructured it for a number of reasons, but it became a way that they could get rid of me.
That sucks.
It was not, that job was like an abusive relationship. So, I continually told myself that I could tolerate anything because I only had to be there 3 days a week. But in fact, I was, you know, devalued, undermined, ignored. You know, it was not a good work environment at all. But I had my insurance and I had my time and I was an artist and I had a kind of stability that my other artist friends didn't have.
Yeah. So,
but coming here and having support and being able to do the things that I want to do to create, you know, a part of the department is a huge shift in my work environment. It's a completely different thing to have people appreciate what you're doing and for you to like what you're, who you're working with, both faculty, and I love working with the students, and it's a good fit because I need to, because I can take my art background and use it. You know, I get to talk to the students about their work and how to use technology, how to use the laser cutter, the large format printers, in as drawing tools to make, you know, what's in their head a thing outside their head. So, yeah.
That's perfect. That was my next question, is how you liked it here. So. Like, we're sitting in your office now, and it's full of art books, and you got a giant print scanner. And the little VRC library's right outside. You've got a cool little spot here.
It's messy, but it's okay. I have a corner office.
Ooh.
Right? Yeah. So, I, you know, my other job in AV, where you're, you know, editing video and such, it was a windowless room. So, I mean, 30 years, I was in an interior space in a windowless room. And I actually had a studio for 5 years, 6 years, that was, had a skylight, but it didn't have any windows. Oh. So, yeah, it was a weird,
one
weird
ceiling
thing.
Window.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm glad you've got windows here.
It's pretty nice. I also am actually outside living here, that I'm not in Seattle.
Oh, yeah. When did you get your house?
The house we got 4 years ago. So 3 acres of dirt and yard and garden and, yeah.
Oh, yeah, because you're a master gardener now, aren't you?
I am. Went through that program twice because it was hard for me to wrap around all that dirt.
We have a lot of that out here.
Yeah, well, I had a lot of established gardens to not kill. And, you know, I moved from a 500 square foot apartment. Never occurred to me to be interested in anything that had to do with dirt. And now I'm obsessed. So it's taken over everything. It's complicated my relationship with Seattle, because I had this vision of being in Seattle anytime I wasn't here, right? So like Liz, you know, can I get my job to a 9-month status so I could be in Seattle for 4 months out of the year? So I could, you know, have long weekends up there. And now, you know, I don't want to leave the property over the summer. And it's complicated.
It's a lot of weeding when you leave for 3 months.
Well, everything would be dead, right?
Yeah.
So, 100-degree temperatures, for God's sake.
You've put down some physical roots here.
I have, no pun intended.
Maybe a little bit. I'm glad that you're here.
Thank you.
Because I worked for you for, what, 2 years while I was still a student?
Yeah.
And it was so...
Was it two and a half? Two.
Yeah, 4 semesters.
Well, you've just been around, so...
Yeah, you can't get rid of me now.
Yeah. Well, I am. You're going to Seattle.
And I'm going to move into your apartment.
For a little while, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was kind of fun.
Yeah. But it made such a difference to be around somebody who was a grown-up and, like, a cool married queer person.
Yeah.
Because that's not something that you see around a lot in Oklahoma, especially growing up here like I did.
Yeah.
So thank you for being you.
Thank you. You're welcome.
Usually I have a last question, and that's if you have advice for kids like coming to college now and wanting to go into art but don't really fit into the like solitary male genius artist stereotype that you fought against.
Oh, God, I hope that is completely dead. But I'm not in school now. I think the question about being an art student is better answered by Liz or by Louise. Like, faculty have their elevator speech about recruitment, I think is a weird word, but a way to explain to parents what an art education is. We live in a very visual culture, and it just gets more visual literacy is really important. And, you know, you have kids graduating from all sorts of discipline. Like, how many kids are in psychology? Are they going to become psychologists? No, probably not. But will they find ways to work in the field? Maybe. But maybe they go into business. Maybe they go into real estate. Maybe they go into something else. It's like the kinds of skills that you get with a broad humanities education is really critical to function in this society. It's a highly technical, fast-moving society, but it relies on ideas. And how do you develop ideas, and where do those ideas come from, and what ideas do you take from the past? What philosophies, what research, what art and culture? And in a time with a lot of I think culture brings people together. I think art creates community. I think you see that with Valerie Bloodgood bringing and putting Modella together, or Prairie Arts and its association with the university, with the OSU Art Museum, and how those things reach out to the non-university community. I think it's very hard in a university that's in a rural area like Champaign-Urbana or Stillwater to have the in Champaign, it was the townies, right? That's just how it was referred to. And the university is sort of this behemoth that takes over properties and, you know, thinks that they're the dominant culture. But I think that there's a way that that art and community involvement are bridges. Not just a university and rural environment, but in all sorts of ways, art is a cultural touchstone that can what's the sentence I'm looking for? It just connects people and beyond sort of the political divisions, the economic divisions, you know, the class divisions that can be exacerbated when everybody kind of goes to their tribe. So, you know, music is really important. Performance is really important. Visual arts are really important. That is how we know about cultures before us, right? We know about the Greeks, the Romans, you know, people in whatever China, we know from their writings, from their books, from their art, from their sculpture, from their architecture. It is the architecture of their civilization and what you leave people. So you eliminate the arts, you eliminate the humanities, you eliminate your ability to communicate who you are to future generations.
That's an excellently strong argument for the humanities. Thank you so much.
Yeah.
I forgot to ask about this, but you were telling me about a TV show that you saw recently.
Do you need to preface this file as connected to me?
This is still Sally Hsu. It's still July 17th. This is still the OSU Diverse Sexuality and Gender Oral History Project.
Yeah. Here we are. Yes. Go ahead. What were you going to ask me?
Telling me about seeing a guy who moved the same way that you did.
Ah, so there is a Netflix series that I heard about, NPR, Terry Gross, some interview. It's a guy who created, writes, and stars in a show called Special. And he has mild cerebral palsy, ambulatory, very similar neurological involvement to mine. He is also a gay man. So there is a lot of storyline about how he navigates those two things. And to see, there's some of it that is not reflected back to me, but I can think of only one or two instances where I have seen someone with my gait. And I think that there's some analogy to finding out that someone is queer, that there's someone else in the world that likes the same gender, that there's someone else in the world that feels like they're in the wrong body, that there's someone else in the world that is, I think there are lots of ways we have access to that now, but this was a really profound experience for me to watch this, and the added level of having him be navigating disability and queerness and the visibility of those two things. He talks about coming out as a gay man when he was 17, but not coming out as disabled until he was in his late 20s. He, by omission, someone made the assumption that his gait was due to an accident. Now, why you wouldn't put a disability label on that either. You know what I'm saying? It's like his definition of disability, and like you could have a whole nother conversation about how do you use that label in the same way, how do you use, gay, lesbian, queer. But so he talks about then coming out to say, no, this isn't a car accident. I have this thing. It's called cerebral palsy, and how people respond to that. And mostly people just couldn't care less. But he had all this shame around that. And in his narrative, he wasn't disabled enough to be part of a disability community, whatever club he thought that was, or he wasn't able-bodied enough to be quote-unquote normal. He was, that's the title of the show, special. So I don't think it's a very good show, but it brings up issues for me, and I think about how my experience is similar, or my belief system is similar, or how it's different, but having those two the language I'm using here isn't quite accurate, it's just off the top of my head, but having those two categories of otherness and having to navigate both of those and how they're similar and how they're different. But to kind of bring it all full circle and some of the things that I said before, in some ways, I think both of those aspects of myself gave me a lot of freedom, right? I didn't fit in. So why would I bother working to fit in? I could just follow whatever it was I was interested in.
That's awesome. Okay.
Okay, we're done.
Thank you for sharing.
Yes.